is the Middle East correspondent for the London Independent and has been covering the Middle East for 26 years. He's just coming in from Bethlehem last week and is on his way back there, although he's stationed in Beirut. So without further ado, here is Robert.
Ladies and gentlemen, normally I'm the person who says please switch off the mobile phones, and in Dublin the other day I said that, and to my usual anger, a phone rang. Of course it was mine, and I had to turn it off. I'm going to start with a question to you tonight. Why doesn't Colin Powell go to Geneva? What has happened to the world's moral compass, indeed to the United States, when America's most famous ex-general, the Secretary of State of the most powerful country on earth, on a supposedly desperate mission to stop the bloodshed in the Middle East, fails to grasp what is taking place in front of his nose? The stench of decaying corpses, according to my colleagues whom I spoke to this morning near Jenin, is wafting out of the Palestinian city. The Israeli army is still keeping the Red Cross and journalists from seeing the evidence of the killings which have taken place there. Hundreds, on Israel's own admission, have died, including some civilians. Why, in heaven's name, can't Mr. Powell demand an explanation for the extraordinary and apparently sinister events that have taken place in Jenin? Instead, after joshing with Ariel Sharon after his arrival in Jerusalem on Friday, Powell, I think, is playing games. Now, he's been demanding, of course, that Yasser Arafat condemns Friday's vicious suicide bombing in Jerusalem. The 6 dead and 65 wounded people from that bombing, we have the details of. But he has failed to utter more than a word of concern for the infinitely more terrible death toll in Jenin. Is Mr. Powell frightened of the Israelis? Does he really have to debase himself in this way? Does he think that meeting Arafat, or refusing to do so, takes precedence over the enormous humanitarian tragedy that has overwhelmed the Palestinians, survivors of Jenin? Is President Bush, whose demand that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon withdraw his troops from the West Bank has been blandly ignored, so cynical as to allow this charade to continue? For this, I suspect, is the end game, the very final proof of whether the United States is morally worthy of being a Middle East peacemaker. Even for one who has witnessed so much duplicity in the Middle East, it is a shock for me to reflect upon the events of the past 9 days. Almost 2 weeks ago, the United Nations Security Council, with the active participation and support, of course, of the United States, demanded an immediate end to Israel's reoccupation of the West Bank and Gaza and an end to violence from the Palestinians as well as the Israelis. President Bush insisted that Sharon should follow the advice of Israel's American friends and, because our own dear Mr. Blair was with him at the time, of Israel's British friends and withdraw. When I say withdraw, I mean it, Bush snapped 3 days later. But of course, it's now clear, I think, that he meant nothing of the kind. Instead, he sent Powell off on his urgent mission of peace, a journey to Israel and the West Bank that would take the Secretary of State an incredible 8 days. Just enough time, Bush presumably thought, to allow his good friend Sharon, as he puts it, to finish his latest adventure in the West Bank. Supposedly unaware that Israel's chief of staff, Shaul Mofaz, has told Sharon, according to the Israeli press, that he needed at least 8 weeks to finish the job of crushing the Palestinian resistance there, Powell wandered off around the Mediterranean, dawdling in Morocco, Spain, Egypt, and Jordan, before finally washing up in Israel on Friday morning. If my editor told me to get to the Middle East and I took 8 days, I don't think I'd have a job left. If Washington firefighters took that long to reach a blaze, the American capital would long ago have turned to ashes. But of course, the purpose of Mr. Powell's idleness, I suspect, was to allow enough time for Jenin to be turned into ashes. Mission, I suppose, accomplished. As Israel's soldiery yesterday continued to hide their deeds from the outside world by preventing the Red Cross, aid workers, ambulances, and journalists from entering the rubble of the Jenin refugee camp, Powell was sitting idly by in Jerusalem, calling for the utmost restraint from an army that has not yet finished filling the mass graves in Jenin. That he should make a visit to Yasser Arafat, the grotesque, corrupt old man of Ramallah, the make-or-break issue of his peacemaking, shows me just how skewed Powell's morality has become. Arafat's advisers, let's not give any credit to the so-called martyr chairman of the Palestinian Authority for this, Arafat's advisers shrewdly announced that it is for Powell to condemn the killings in Jenin before Arafat could be expected to condemn the vicious suicide bombing in Jerusalem on Friday. And even though Arafat mouthed the relevant words of contrition and condemnation this afternoon, I suspect it makes little difference. Mr. Powell will see him tomorrow. All last week, while Mr. Sharon's soldiers were in Jenin, White House spokesman Ari Fleischer was playing the role of Sharon's point man in Washington when Israel announced that its army was pulling out of three tiny West Bank villages, so tiny that none of us had ever heard of them. Fleischer announced that this was a step in the right direction. They've now gone into three more tiny West Bank villages, which we haven't heard of. Then by Friday morning, when even the most dim-witted observer had grasped that something was terribly wrong in Jenin, Fleischer was telling us that Sharon was a man of peace. How much longer, one wondered, could this nonsense continue? Of course, the Palestinians, or whoever directs the sepulchral, nightmarish campaign of suicide bombing, for it surely cannot be the preposterous Arafat, are going for the jugular. The Al-Aqsa Brigades, or Hamas, or Islamic Jihad, clearly intend to ensure that Sharon's ruthless operation fails. The occupation, the reoccupation by the Israelis, after all, was supposed to be preventing these wicked Palestinian crimes, and to prove that Powell is made to look impotent. They seem certain to accomplish both goals up to now. The Palestinian Authority, to all intents and purposes in the West Bank, has for now ceased to exist. And that was surely one of Sharon's intentions. And Powell's weakness, his failure of nerve, is now likely, I think, and I fear, to set off an Israeli-Palestinian war even more terrible than we've witnessed so far. But let's pause for a quick journey down memory lane to September 1982, when Ariel Sharon was, quote, rooting out the network of terror, unquote, in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Beirut. I was there at the time. On the third day of that massacre, I got into the camp when the murderers were still there. So I have a very clear and vivid memory, and will have for all my life, of what I saw and what I remember Sharon said then. Before sending Israel's murderous phalangist militia allies into the camps, Sharon told the world that the Palestinians had assassinated the phalangist leader Bashir Jamail. This was totally untrue, but the Falange believed him. And evidence is now emerging in Beirut that long after the Americans had called for Israel to withdraw the killers from the camps in 1982, the Israeli army, commanded of course by then Defense Minister Sharon, handed more than 1,000 survivors of the massacre over to those same murderers, and they were subsequently slaughtered over the following 2 weeks. This primarily, I suspect, is why Mr. Sharon is so worried by the attempts to indict him for war crimes in Brussels. Hasn't Mr. Powell, I wonder, glanced through the State Department archives in 1982? Hasn't he read what Sharon said back then? The same ranting about, quote, terror, terror networks, rooting out terror. The very same words that Sharon employs today, a lexicon which Mr. Powell himself is now enthusiastically using. Has he forgotten that the Israeli Kahan Commission held Sharon personally responsible for the massacre of those 1,700 civilians? Even if we dismiss all the Palestinian claims of civilian butchery in Jenin, extrajudicial executions, and the wholesale destruction of thousands of homes, what on earth does he think the Israelis are hiding in Jenin? Why doesn't Mr. Powell go and look? Yes, the Palestinian suicide campaign is immoral, unforgivable, insupportable. One day the Arabs, never ones to look in the mirror when it comes to their own crimes, will have to acknowledge the sheer cruelty of their tactics. They have not done this so far. But since the Israelis never attempted to confront the immorality of shooting to death child stone throwers in the early days of the Intifada, or the evil of their reckless death squads, who went around murdering Palestinians on their wanted list, along with the usual clutch of women and kids who got in the way, is this any wonder? In the annals of war, the conflict in the Middle East has reached a new apogee. But the story of the United States' involvement in the Middle East will not, I think, be the same again. Thanks to Mr. Powell and Mr. Bush and Mr. Sharon, America's credibility has been shattered among even its Arab friends. The Secretary of State sings now from the Israeli songbook. So when, oh when, some of us ask in Europe, will the Europeans screw their courage to the sticking place and become the peacemakers of the Middle East? Already, Europe's leaders are angrily talking of American failure in the Middle East, of the failure of America's peace process. They realize, I think, that the vicious Palestinian suicide bombings are part of a Palestinian insurrection against Israeli occupation, which began after the Camp David talks broke down between Israel, the United States, and the Palestinians in 2000. At this meeting, Israel supposedly, or so American reporters claimed at the time, offered the Palestinians East Jerusalem as a capital and state comprising 94 or 96 or 98%, as you wish, of the West Bank and Gaza. My Jerusalem colleague, Phil Reeves, and I looked through the details, and this is what we found. Arafat was not offered sovereignty over East Jerusalem. He was offered what Madeleine Albright once called a sort of sovereignty over certain Arab streets in East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem now being a majority Jewish population, of course. And sovereignty over the Haram al-Sharif mosque area, but not beneath it, where lies the Temple Mount, or where it was. Arafat was expected to accept that Jerusalem would remain the unified and eternal capital of Israel. Arafat's capital, or at least his parliament, will be in a village called Abu Dis, below the walls of East Jerusalem. Large Jewish settlements like Male Adumim, would remain, extending Israel's Jerusalem municipal boundaries deep into the Arab West Bank. This was part of the occupied West Bank, which was now non-negotiable. A 10-mile Israeli military buffer zone would surround Arafat's so-called Palestinian state. Other Jewish settlements, for Jews and Jews only, of course, would remain. A few of them might be leased back to Israel on the basis that it was Palestinian land, but Palestinians wouldn't be living on it, for 25-year leases. In return, the Palestinians would be given a bit of the Israeli Negev desert and some territorial waters, we believe, on the Dead Sea. And as you realize, despite the amount of salt in it, you can't actually build houses on the Dead Sea. In all, Phil and I found that Arafat was probably being offered around 45 to 46% of the occupied Arab West Bank and Gaza. That's at most 46% of the 22% of Palestine that was up for negotiation. And of course, Arafat walked out. Because its collapse is intimately linked to the terrible war that has now broken out, I must, albeit briefly, outline why I believe the so-called peace process, and I never did find out who invented the words peace process, ended as it did. In 1991, as we know, Arabs and Israelis were invited to Madrid to discuss a peace agreement based on UN Security Council Resolution 242. And 242, as we know, called for the withdrawal of Israeli forces from territory captured in the 1967 war, the occupied West Bank, Gaza, Golan, East Jerusalem, in return for the security of the states in the area, including Israel. It also reaffirmed that territory could not be acquired through war. But the Oslo agreement between Israel and the PLO effectively allowed Israel to renegotiate 242. Under Oslo, Israel would decide which bits of territory it would return to the Arabs and which bits it would keep. Illegal Jewish settlements continued to expand on still occupied land in defiance of international law. The system of Palestinian control over one area, Area A, joint control over Area B, and Israeli control over Area C, meant that the occupied territories were razored to bits. All the most contentious issues, Jerusalem, the so-called right of return, the future of the settlements, were left to final status talks, as if a newly married couple could be forced to love and trust one another, providing they were first forced to get married. In the meanwhile, a whole slew of other agreements were entered into, and not one of them was respected. The Oslo II Taba Agreement, concluded by Yitzhak Rabin in September 1995, promised three Israeli withdrawals from Zone A and Zone C to be completed by October of 1997. The final status agreement was to have been completed by October 1999. by which time occupation was supposed to have ended. Interim accords went against the Palestinians. In January of 1997, a handful of settlers were granted 20% of Hebron, despite the fact that Oslo committed Israel to leave all West Bank towns. By October 1988, Israel had not carried out, 1998, Israel had not carried out the Tabor Accords. Benjamin Netanyahu then negotiated a new agreement at Y River, which divided the second redeployment promised of Tabor into two phases. He carried out only the first. Netanyahu promised to reduce Zone C from 72% Israeli control to 59%, transferring 41% of the West Bank to Zones A and B. In September 1999, Ehud Barak reneged on Y River, turning Netanyahu's two-phase withdrawal into three phases, the first of which would transfer only 7% from Zone C to Zone B. You don't have to take a note of the details, which are accurate, but you get the drift. Throughout this period, Jewish settlement expansion increased from a population of 80,000 to 150,000, despite Oslo's stricture that neither side should take such, quote, unilateral steps. Yet each new agreement in the Oslo process was hailed by reporters as a breakthrough, as a sign that the peace process had been put, how tired I am when I hear this cliche, back on track. As Oslo slowly collapsed, American journalists reassured their readers and viewers that it was, if delayed, still alive, still leading towards the always elusive peace. Opponents of Oslo were, as I've said, regarded as being anti-peace and thus supporters of terrorism, which meant, of course, that few journalists were going to explain why Oslo was failing. When it became clear that the whole structure was about to fall into the abyss, both Israelis and Palestinians were invited to those Camp David talks. Now we find, incredibly, that the idea of a transfer, in other words, the forced eviction of all Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza to other Arab countries, is being seriously discussed. We are talking here about ethnically cleansing the Palestinians from their homes. An Israeli opinion poll asked its readers whether they approved of transfer, whether this might be an option. More than 30% of Israelis thought this a viable option. It was discussed, this idea of transfer, in all seriousness, in an article in USA Today. But I would ask you, if ethnic cleansing is now to be a seriously discussed policy option, and since ethnic cleansing is a war crime, what the hell is Milosevic doing in The Hague? Let me make a small digression here. Last month, aware that I was going to be addressing you today, I took a walk through the Sabra and Shatila refugee camp in Beirut. With me was a friend who had never visited the camp before but knew its sinister, tragic history. I showed him the mass grave site where more than 500 of the Palestinian civilians massacred by the Falangists were buried in 1982. Today, it is a rubbish dump. There is no memorial to the dead. Bombed by the Israelis throughout the 1982 invasion, an earlier killing spree, which we have now erased from our memories, blown up by the Falangists in the aftermath of their own war crimes, fought over at even greater human cost during the 1985 camps war with the Lebanese Shiite militias, Sabra and Shatila is today a waste pit. Syrian workers run a market at the entrance. A refuse tip is prowled over by youths for old car parts and boxes. Rats infest the only paved road. And amid the shanty town of concrete huts, where live the survivors of the 1982 horror, there are underground graveyards, the final resting place of those Palestinians killed in the camps war, whose relatives could never bury them in daylight amid the shell fire. As we walked out of the camp, I asked my companion, who would have been 9 when I myself hid amid these ruins on the last day of the massacre, before the Falangists had left, what he was thinking. If I lived here, he said, I would go mad. And I remembered that I had said the same when asked the same question by an American magazine executive 7 years ago. And I recalled for him then that one of the Palestinians accused of an attack on El Al passengers at Vienna Airport in the 80s had told police, I am from Sabra and Shatila. Indeed, the American magazine editor later returned with a group of newspaper executives from New York. They visited one of the massacre survivors with me, sat on the floor of her hut and drank hot tea and listened to her story. When she had finished, she asked them, "Why does the United States allow this to happen to us? Why does America give planes to Israel? Why don't you help us go back to our homes in Palestine?" And I recall very clearly how the executive sitting nearest to me on the floor nodded in genuine sympathy, jotted a few words in his notebook, and then, like his colleagues, sat staring at the woman with a smile of understanding. And the Palestinian woman kept staring at him. After perhaps 10 seconds, I said gently to the Americans, "I think she wants a reply." The American next to me fidgeted slightly and said, "Well, it's not that simple, and it would take quite a long time to explain." Indeed it would. But of course, we journalists are cynical folk. I used to ask the Palestinians I knew in that camp if they thought they would return to Palestine. A few knew there was a UN resolution. They didn't know the crucial difference between the Security Council and the General Assembly, and the number 194 would have left most of them mystified. But yes, they would insist they would return to Galilee, to Haifa, and to Acre. As the years passed, and I asked the same question of the same survivors, their conviction began to falter. God willing is not the same as yes. And once they had understood the true meaning of the Oslo Accord, a few souls would simply shrug their shoulders at my question. Most years, I write an article on the anniversary of the 1982 massacre. Usually I preface my report with the claim that the London Independent, my own paper, will be the only one recording the anniversary. I am invariably right. And I always ask, if the position were reversed, and pray God it never is, whether this awful date would be remembered. Had the victims been Israelis, I often ask myself, and no sane or decent person would wish this, but had the victims been Israelis, and the perpetrators, not Israel's allies, but armed Palestinians, would the cemetery be a garbage tip? Would America's journalists, now warned by the US ambassador in Lebanon, to avoid the camps because of terrorism, would those American reporters so regularly and so uniquely ignore the anniversary of Sabra and Shatila? I do not think so. There would be photographs, there would be long interviews with survivors each year. American presidents, I suspect, would arrive to stand before such a place of infamy in order to remember the innocent dead. But of course, Sabra and Shatila is in Lebanon, and its survivors are disenfranchised non-people, waiting to return to homes over whose ruins the world has constructed a new nation. The victims of the massacre were killed by the wrong murderers allied to the wrong side in the Arab-Israeli tragedy. What happened here has been erased by us journalists as surely as the villages from which the victims came. I try to show you only the human side of this tragedy, but let me conclude very briefly. The Palestinians have fought the Israelis most cruelly. Who, Hanan Ashrawi, bravely asked this year, decided that the Palestinian Intifada should be fought at the cost of the lives of Israeli women and children inside Israel. But Israel's war is not a war on terror. It is, I think, the last colonial war, fought by an occupied people against a nation which uses our old British colonial laws and, of course, is supported by the United States. There are courageous Israelis who say this. There are fine Israeli journalists like Amir Ahas and Gideon Levy who say this publicly. Palestine is not occupying Israel. Israel is occupying Palestine. And until that occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, all the occupied territory I'm talking about, including East Jerusalem, ends, along with an end to settlements, I do not see how Israel will ever have security. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your patience.